7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. Always good to see you boys. I think we got an interesting discussion to take place today regarding an accident in an airport that I'm very familiar with, having grown up in Maryland and spent my summers at the beach in Ocean City, Maryland. I flew into the Ocean City Airport quite a bit, and this accident is related to that particular airport. But before we get there, Todd, I know that we have a number of people and organizations to at least congratulate and talk about.
Indeed, including one of our, in fact, our newest sponsor, ProChalk, which not only are they a sponsor, one of us here at least is a customer. ProChalk makes customized.
Why, yes, I am. That is the company name that I put my airplanes in, and I do have the low-profile ProChalks. I like them. They're high-density rubber, and they definitely, you know, it's easy to throw them in the back of the airplane, but they do the job. And I know that you can get them, depending on the size of your airplane, you can get them in a variety of different sizes, but I like the fact that, you know, they put my company name on here. You can put your N number on it. You can put anything you want on there. And the folks that that actually own the organization are great. John and I had an opportunity to talk with them at Oshkosh.
Yeah, they were. In fact, when they approached us, we approached them to be a sponsor. I told them that while we were at Oshkosh, you bought a set of their chalks. Yeah. And chalks are one of those things that everybody takes for granted. We all know that how important they can be, but they really get abused and taken for granted. And I learned that lesson really early in my career, because we had a guy, you know, I hung around at the airport all the time, every free moment I was at the airport. And one day I happened to watch this guy from afar, and he was working on his airplane, not wrenching, but doing things around on his airplane. And he removed the chalks and put them aside. And a little bit later, I saw him getting ready to hand crank his airplane. I didn't think much of it. And he got it started, hand cranked it, and it immediately started to roll. Now, he must have had too much throttle on it. But he was able to swing himself around quickly and get to the airplane and get it stopped. Actually killed the engine, if I remember right. And I learned a valuable lesson that day about paying attention to chalks.
So, yeah, but John, when you were flying, I mean, they didn't have this rubber stuff called chalks. Weren't you using logs or bricks or something for wheel chalks? Because, I mean, maybe mounds of dirt. I mean, it's been a long time since, you know, the Wright brothers started flying. What did the Wright brothers use for chalks?
They had skids on their first plane. They
didn't had skids, yeah.
That's right. Well,
there were wooden chalks back. What I remember is wooden chalks.
Well, we're happy that ProChalks is a sponsor of the show, and we look forward to a long-lasting relationship, because I'm going to continue to buy my own two sets of them now. So, and what else do we have, Todd, before we really get into to dissecting this accident?
Well, the thing that we always have is a need for sponsors. And one of the things I want to, talk about is our mission here. Our mission at the Flight Safety Detectives is very simple, and we're going to show you that today, to dig deep and bring you the stories, lessons, and sometimes the hard truths that make aviation safer for everyone. Because this work matters to us and others around the world, we put in the hours and the energy to bring you insights you will not get anywhere else, especially sometimes from the official NTSB report, but we'll get into that later. And we aim to keep the conversation clear, honest, and independent, which is why we're seeking sponsors to share our commitment to this mission. If your company is connected to aviation, whether it's training, technology, or services that helps aviation professionals, we'd love to partner with you. When you sponsor the show, you're not just putting your name in front of our audience of engaged, safety-conscious listeners. You're supporting work that helps keep aviation safer worldwide. And to learn more about how you can be a sponsor, email us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll work with you to make sure your message really lands.
Well, that's great because, like you see on my vest, Avemco is one of our primary sponsors as well. And I've got my CFI insurance as well as my aircraft insurance through them. So, we are always looking for new sponsors who really have a commitment to safety. So we look forward to new ones.
You know, in that vein, Greg, I just was talking to somebody at the FBO here just a short time ago, and he was lamenting about his insurance broker. I guess he had some sort of a problem, and he was just bemoaning the fact that he didn't get the kind of service he expected for what he was paying for. And we made that visit to Frederick, Maryland, to Avemco. And we listened to them handling a number of complaints, or not complaints, but claims. And not once did I hear that out of any of those folks. You know, they're knowledgeable aviation people. They're not just insurance people. Many of them fly. They all fly the simulator that they have right there in their facility. So, I mean, they're a different kind of aviation insurance company, obviously.
And that's why I've stuck with them for as long as I have, because I've had all my airplanes insured. And my dad's airplane was insured through Avemco as well. So I've always had great service with them. So, given that, Todd, why don't you give us a little summary of the accident we're going to talk about? Because I've got some issues with the NTSB report and a bunch of unanswered questions to put everything in perspective.
Well, this is a particular accident that happened in 2018, and it happened at the Ocean City Airport in Maryland. There was a person who was getting some night currency in. This pilot was flying from Martin State Airport, going out toward Ocean City. It's about 86 nautical miles as the crow flies. Took off right at sunset, was planning to get some touch-and-go landings in, apparently, and then head back to the airport. To paint you a picture, this was a night flight. He had arrived to Ocean City after civil aviation twilight had ended, so it was technically night. There was a 10,000-foot overcast and a nearly full moon, about 98% full. But that overcast did a couple of things. The moonlight's not going to be as bright because you have an overcast. And because Ocean City is near the Atlantic Ocean, depending on which way the aircraft is pointing, you could be pointing over the ocean and have an indistinct horizon. Why is this important? This pilot was not instrument rated. He was a visual flight rules for this particular flight, had a passenger with him who apparently was not a pilot. So it wasn't a case where he had someone with instrument rating experience or CFI or what have you in the cockpit with him. And some of the decisions that were made were kind of questionable. One of them being, and this is one of the things we saw when we looked carefully at the report, he had only about 3 hours of experience in the previous 90 days. 2 of those 3 hours were on the day of the accident. So in the last 90 days prior to this accident, this pilot only had 1 hour of experience, which calls into question, are you going to have night currency with a passenger on board if in the previous 90 days you only had 1 hour of flying of any kind? But the event here, there was a flight, apparently not anything out of the ordinary going there, according to a witness on the ground. a witness whose statement was not included in the final report, I might add. This pilot was doing some touch and goes, then left the area. There was an oil slick found about 2 miles offshore the next day, and wreckage of the aircraft was found in that area as well. And from some of the pictures you're looking at on those of you watching the video version of this, the aircraft structure that was recovered was fairly mangled, which is indicating to me, and I think to you, Greg and John, that this was not a case of the aircraft settling gently into the ocean in a planned ditching. This was a high-energy impact with the ocean. And unfortunately, both the pilot and the passenger were killed. And digging further into this story, and you can go into this more in detail, Greg, the probable cause was the pilot's flight in dark night visual meteorological conditions, which resulted in an impact with water for reasons that could not be determined based on the available information. That's their story, and they're sticking to it. But there's other available information, especially in the public docket, which gave questions to us that were not answered by this report.
Yeah, I mean, one, there's a rental agreement as one of the documents in the public docket. He, apparently the renter, had some sort of relationship with this flight school to rent the aircraft. They're the ones that provided the information to the NTSB about this pilot's total time of 81 hours and then the flight time he had in the last 90 days. I'm surprised that they don't have more records regarding any kind of night flight. And if I was the investigator, I would have tried to track down whether or not, and at least make a statement in the report, whether or not he got his flight training at that airport or any kind of flight training at that flight school. The reason being is, again, you brought up the point that he only had 3 hours and 90 days, two of which were on the day of the accident. Well, you got to meet two requirements under 6157. One, of course, you got to have three takeoffs and landings, touch and goes during the day to be current. And then at night, you got to have three takeoffs and landings to a full stop to be night current in order to carry passengers. None of that was revealed. I'm not sure the questions were ever asked. Because that I would have been asking those questions. And if the flight school didn't know, I would have definitely made a statement to it. But apparently they had some sort of records and they had to have some sort of validation that he met their requirements to even rent an aircraft. Now, one of the recommendations in the 6120.1, which is basically the operator statement, because the pilot was fatal, the flight school operator would have filled this out. They made a recommendation regarding night currency and night flights with flight instructors and that kind of stuff. Okay, that's all well and good, but they should have had more complete records, even a copy of his logbook pages that demonstrate that he met the flight school qualifications. None of that's discussed in the report, nor is it provided as a document in the public docket. So, I mean, right there, you know, to make a blanket statement as a probable cause that, you know, you don't know why this airplane went into the water. Well, again, I think it's obvious that the pilot lost control in some form or fashion or flew the aircraft into the water as the board has suggested. But you could probably hone that even further if you really understood more about his flying background and experience. So I've got some issues there, just to start. And then you brought up the point, John, that, you know, one of the things that Todd talked about was that there was a witness on the ground. Why is it that the operator has talked about the witness in the 6120.1? Where's the NTSB and the FAA? I mean, there was a gaggle of people that participated in this investigation. Where's the work they did to find not only the witness that's identified by the operator, but any other witnesses that may have been out there? Witnesses are critical, and this witness said that he was doing touch and goes. I would have asked the question, how many touch and goes did he do?
What time was it when he was doing them? Like, there's just all sorts of basic information that's missing. Yeah. I wonder if they did. Well, you said there was a gaggle of people here. So it sounds like it wasn't very thorough on the on-scene portion.
Well, they wrote it off to a real obvious probable cause. Pilot lost control and crashed in the water. Well, hell, you don't need to leave the office to figure these kinds of things out.
And I'd like
the
to make
question is...
a quick comment on the logbook of this pilot. In the final report, it said the pilot's logbooks were not available for review. Okay. Were they not available because they were lost in the accident, or not available because nobody looked for them?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've been down this road before. We've been critical of the investigators. But again, as a flight school, all the flight schools I've ever flown out of, they always take a copy of, you know, your currency pages or your last, you know, page with your totals and that kind of stuff. I mean, none of that, no, none of it's referenced, and definitely it's not provided in the public docket as a copy. So, I mean, it's just sloppy. Then on top of it, you have this witness who said, yeah, I saw him doing touch and goes, and then he departed the area. Well, what constitutes departing the area? Now, Todd, you had mentioned that they found the oil slick in the aircraft wreckage basically 2 miles off the end of the runway. Now, we've just talked about it. First off, you're not going to fly B-52 patterns in a Cessna 172 doing touch and goes. So
and
it's
another
obvious.
Thing to remember, this the runway he was using, the departure end of the runway goes out over the ocean. And again,
correct.
If this person were doing touch and goes with the intent of going back to the departure airport, they wouldn't be going east. They'd be going to the northwest.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to climb to 400, 500, 600 feet, make a left turn or a right turn, depending on the traffic pattern, and, you know, stay in the pattern. You're going to stay, you know, very close to go outbound, straight out 2 miles. I mean, I know what it's like because I've flown out over the ocean 2 miles. That's a long way, especially at night when you don't have an instrument rating. You got 81 hours of experience. Now, if you're going to, you know, make the turn, because the airport sits at the south end of Ocean City, Maryland, you're going to make a left turn to go fly up the beach and look at the lights and all that kind of fun stuff. You're not going 2 miles offshore to do that. You're basically going to go about a mile, not even that, and make the left turn and fly up the shoreline. So it's curious that this pilot went out that far east off the end of the runway out over the dark ocean with no visible horizon and without an instrument rating. Really, an artificial horizon is worthless to somebody who doesn't really have the experience to use it. You know, that's just some of the questions that have not been answered. It's just sad. I mean, if you're going to spend the time and the energy to investigate an accident, then do your job. Thorough and methodical. Ask these questions. Get that information, because that helps at least put together a more complete picture of, you know, this pilot, this experience. What's the lessons learned out of this? Well, the lessons learned are basically some of the recommendations that came from the flight school, who has instituted new policies based on this accident, which those are great lessons learned. The question is, why did they wait to do it until there was an accident?
We'll take a short break to talk about one of our sponsors. Pilots know it's the little details that matter. That's why at ProChock, they make high-quality premium rubber wheel chocks designed to protect your plane. They are even personalized with your tail number or business logo. Every set of ProChock wheel chocks is made right here in the USA by a small family business that's proud to serve the aviation community. With the holidays coming up, they make an awesome gift, practical, personal, and built to last. Check them out at ProChock.com and use code FLIGHT10 for 10% off your order. That's ProChock.com with code FLIGHT10 for 10% off. ProChock, small business, big support for your plane. This
yeah.
accident was in 2018, and this was an era where there's plenty of ADS-B receivers out there. And unfortunately, both the radar track and the ADS-B, I was able to, and those of you looking at the screen will see the last flight of this aircraft from FlightAware. The track sort of ends short of the airport. So there's no ADS-B track of what touch and goes, if any, this pilot did, and certainly none that go out over the ocean.
What was the altitude on that track? What's the altitude and the ground speed?
At the end, the altitude was about 1,200 feet at the end of when they were about 3 miles short of the airport and going at about 120 knots.
First off, that airplane must have been going downhill. To get a 172 going 120 knots ground speed, you either have a very good tailwind or you push the nose over and you're going downhill.
They were about 3,000 feet before they started the heading downward. This is about, I'd say, 3 minutes before the recording ended.
Okay. Second off, given the fact that that airport is basically sea level, 1,000 feet above, okay, he's going to be at about traffic pattern altitude. So if they've picked him up on radar at 1,200 feet, why isn't there more radar hits during these touch and goes when he's climbed back up to pattern altitude? Plus, there's other radar sites up and down the East Coast that would have picked him up. It's apparent that they didn't bother looking for those because there's just nothing out there. I mean, it's relatively flat. The whole Eastern Shore is relatively flat. You don't have any mountains, you don't have high buildings and that kind of stuff. And the radar sites should take you 1,200 feet or even lower in some cases, depending on where the site is. There's no mention about that and the fact that they tried to get additional data to see what was available. And again, that's just sloppy, lazy work. I mean, at least ask the question, you got the FAA, just ask them to hunt it down. I mean, there's military sites. I've used AWACS airplane information on occasion to get additional data where radar data wasn't available. So, I mean, there are a lot of different sources. Well, the sad thing is, John, I know why they didn't do it. One, because they're lazy. And two, they didn't bother to ask the question, but that just means more work. This was an easy write-off. Pilot got disoriented or pilot lost control for unknown reasons and crashed. Write it off, get rid of it, and move on. And that's just, it's unfair. Not only
Well, you know,
to, yeah.
when I looked at that, Greg, they did do a lot, a fair job at least of uncovering a lot of the things that we just talked about. All right, so they were in the public docket. They never made it into the final report, which says to me that this sat on somebody's desk, all right, and just sat there and sat there and sat there until management said, "What's going on with that? Get that out." It had grown whiskers, so to speak. And they just push it out, and it just went once over lightly because they never went back and answered any of the questions you just asked. Although they had breadcrumbs and going in that direction, they just didn't follow them.
Yeah, what was the published date on this? Do you know,
It was
Todd?
published in May 2020. The event occurred at the end of February 28, 2018. So about 27 months after the event, it was published.
What the hell have they been doing for 27 months?
Well, at
That's
the
what.
same area, they noted that the NTSB did not travel to the scene of the accident, so they saved a little time there.
Well, that's even worse. I was just having a discussion today, as a matter of fact, with somebody regarding how many accidents. And again, I've talked about this in the past, that the FAA is doing about 80% of the on-scene investigations for the NTSB. It may be a little higher, especially now since we are in a shutdown and that kind of stuff. But the FAA is considered essential. The NTSB has decided that they aren't essential and that they're only going to go out on major investigations. Well, guess what? People die in small airplanes. And at least when I was working at the NTSB and went through a number of shutdowns, we were considered essential as investigators. They may have sent the administrative staff home, but I was on multiple trips, two of which were, I was out of the country. The other thing that really bothers me is the fact that they use this as an excuse. We're not allowed to do this, we're not allowed to do that, and we're not getting paid. Well, you are getting paid because once the government gets back to operating budget, you all get back pay. It's not like you're never going to see that money. And fortunately, my father, who was a government employee, long government employee, basically told me you always have to have a slush fund when you work for the government for the times when, in the event of a shutdown, you're going to be able to survive until they square it away and you get paid. But the fact is, you can't be using these kinds of excuses to not do your job in 2018 when there was no shutdown. You depend on the FAA. The FAA's primary responsibility is not acts investigation. It is oversight and enforcement. Do they get axe investigation training? Yeah, but they collect the obvious stuff. That's why the NTSB investigator gets paid, is to do all of the other things that need to be done to ensure that this is a thorough and methodical investigation. And there are benefits to every single accident. I don't care how simple or obvious it is. There are lessons to be learned. And this is just, one of those things. Because the message to flight schools is, you know what? You better make sure that you have a very good rental program so you don't find yourself in the same position of this particular flight school.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the flight school because, in fact, in the 6120, there's information that was not included in the final report, and it had to do with the change in the rental agreement that happened after the event. Under the section Operator Owner Safety Recommendation, this is apparently written by the flight school, we have instituted new policies for private pilots without instrument ratings to include the following. No night touch-and-goes or stop-and-goes without an instructor on board. Point of fact, this airplane did not have an instructor on board, but apparently a companion, a friend of the pilot who was not rated in any way. Any renter requesting to take an aircraft where night landing will be resulting must have a minimum of 1.5 hours of night flying with an instructor in the preceding 30 days to include three landings to a full stop. KOXB, yeah, which is the Ocean City Airport, is off limits to any non-instrument rated pilot if flight will require a takeoff or landing at night. All flights originating or returning after office hours must have a VFR flight plan filed and activated. Point of fact, this pilot had flight following, but no flight plan.
But he canceled flight following once he got to the airport area. So nobody's talking to him and nobody's watching him.
And it was an untowered airport at that point.
And in all the years that I flew in there, day and night, that was a black hole airport. There wasn't a lot built around the airport. It has since built up over the years. But again, there are areas of black hole. Of course, the ocean is the obvious one. But I mean, those are the safety benefits that can go back into the system for other flight schools who rent airplanes. And, you know, giving them an idea that, hey, maybe we should go back and at least look at our renter policy to make sure that if we're going to rent one of our aircraft, it's very inclusive. It's detailed, because guys like me in my afterlife now, that's what I'm going to look for in any kind of litigation, is those are the attack points. And for the NTSB, that would have been great safety added value from this investigation.
Now, Greg, you raised the issue about searching for the radar. Other radar sites. You know, this airport's not that far from the NAV Air facility in Southern Maryland,
yeah,
where they do an ocean of flight testing. They have multiple radar sites in and around that area. I mean, I'm sure they were tracking this airplane because they got some pretty sophisticated equipment on that base.
Yeah.
And they didn't go for it.
You know, I'll ask the same question about that radar data from NAV Air that I asked about the logbooks. They didn't mention this. But is it because they could not find any radar data, or is the radar data lost and unavailable? Did they even look for it? Just asking.
Yeah. I mean, it's the little things. And while we harp on these little things, people go, you know, that's just being nitpicky. No, it isn't, because I get paid to be an investigator. I get paid to do the job of developing all the facts, conditions, and circumstances to enhance aviation safety in some way, shape, or form. And it's obvious that they wrote this off, like you said, John, sat on somebody's desk. They had to get it. They kicked it out the door with the very easy go-to. And this seems to be their go-to statement. Either you had an engine failure or engine loss of power for unknown reason, or the pilot lost control for unknown reasons. It's because you didn't do your job. If I can figure it out 3 and 4 years later, why can't you do it 3 or 4 days later? And it's that kind of thing that is really a disservice to aviation and aviation safety. I don't care how simple or obvious this accident seems. Two lives were lost, and there is prevention that could be done based on the information from this investigation.
You know, last Friday I taught school, and I had a couple of students come to me and say to me, what kind of advice would you give people that are just coming into the business today. And it's the same advice I would give to anybody in the business, new or old. Pay attention to detail. There is no fact or circumstance that's unimportant in aviation. None. And that seems to be lost a lot today.
Look, I mean, I live by the fact if I put my name on something, that's a signature of my character and the quality of work product. And again, you know, I wouldn't put my name on this report. And as a unit supervisor and a regional director, when I was at the NTSB or when I was doing the Go Team stuff, there's no way I would have ever signed my name to something like this, because somebody's going to ask the questions we just talked about. And if I didn't have the answer, not only would I be embarrassed, but if this was a team effort, the team would have been embarrassed. And John, I mean, I don't remember how many times when we went to Sunshine meetings and of course, our board hearings, you know, you guys, you and the other board members asked a lot of questions, and it was always at least my modus operandi that I'm going to have an answer for you in some way, shape or form, because I've studied it. I know it. And, you know, if I didn't know it, then that's on me. And that was not the way I worked.
Well, unfortunately, there's some people that don't work that way then and today.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm looking at the dates and my memory, which isn't always the best, but my memory says that this was a period of employee turmoil at the NTSB. They had a lot of people leaving. You know, it came off a chairman that was in like 2008 that wasn't the best chairman the board had ever had, and they didn't renew that person. And then we had a period of sort of benign neglect, which means you're just sort of going along and you're not really putting a lot of effort into managing the facility. You know, we had guys like Bernie had left. We had a lot of tough guys leave, you know, yeah. Guys that would hold your feet to the fire in an investigation.
Yeah.
And they have retired out. So they also lost the ability to mentor a lot of the new people coming in. And, you know, that's unfortunate. And they're learning on the fly, and sometimes they're picking up bad habits on the fly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just sad. Because this isn't the first time we've been critical of similar accidents like this, and it's not going to be the last time, because it goes on and on, especially during the COVID period. And we've talked about that, and I'm sure we're going to be pulling some more accidents similar to this that happened during COVID, where the board never went out, basically got not even basic information and have written those accidents off to loss control for unknown reasons and things like that, which there is always a reason. You just got to be an investigator and figure it out. Even if it's circumstantial, here is the most likely cause based on the best available facts, conditions, and circumstances. That's why it's called probable cause, not the cause. But the probable cause is based on the best available facts, conditions, and circumstances. The issue is you got to develop the best factual information. And I don't see that being done.
Now, pulling back just a bit and asking the question, okay, what could have been done? Well, I want to ask that question before saying this. This is a perfect entry into my second to last word. We have this accident. We have our questions about the quality investigation, the depth of the investigation. Here's my question. Who could have prevented this before the fact? Who could have helped us after the fact? I think there are three entities before the fact. First and foremost, the pilot in command. Was the pilot in command honest with himself, who was a gentleman, with respect to his experience, his adherence to the rules, not just the rules of the FAA, but the rules of his flying organization? And was he being honest with his own capabilities as a pilot? If on the surface it was a flight to get night currency, did he really have to have someone else in there with him? Did he really have to fly, you know?
It was illegal to fly with somebody else if he wasn't current and trying to get currency.
And you're flying 86 miles away across one body of water, Chesapeake Bay, to land and take off at an airport next to another body of water, Ocean City airport at night with obscured horizons. So if he had done his work, if he had been cognizant of his limitations, he might have said, you know what, I'm not going to do this. The other entity with the most responsibility here is the flying organization, his flying club. There was a contract signed roughly 8 months before the event, and there was nothing in there that would have put his flight as a red flag. There was no stipulation in there about night flying requirements for that. It was only put in there after the fact, after the horse had run out the barn door. And the least amount of possibility of changing things would have been the passenger. We don't know exactly what the relationship was of the passenger with that flight. There was no mention of this passenger being a pilot or any sort of aviation background at all. So I'm assuming this is a trusting person. They trusted that the person they were flying with knew what he was doing. And this is what I've said before. If you're a passenger on an aircraft, you don't have to be an expert when it comes to aviation. You don't even have to be an expert when it comes to human nature, but you probably have some common sense to know when something's off. If something doesn't seem right to you, if you ask a question or two that's innocent, you don't get an answer that you like, or there's no answer at all, you might say to yourself, you know what? You're a heck of a guy. You're a great pilot, probably. Tell you what, I'll sit here with a cup of tea, and after you come back, we can talk about your flight. But the best decision a passenger, any passenger, can make is to walk away. Last but not least, can the NTSB help us after the fact? It would have been more helpful if there was better information. It would have been more helpful if there were obvious questions that had at least an attempt at an answer. It would have been more helpful if there was something that we could take away from this other than a bunch of complaints about the quality of the research. So it's a long second to last word, but even what seems to be a simple accident has a lot of things you can think about.
You brought up good points. I mean, I would have gone and tried to track down any friends or family of the passenger to see if they knew why this flight was taking place, besides the pilot's friends and family to see why he was taking this flight. I mean, it's all speculation as to what was going on there. So it's these are the little things. And John, Todd brought it up in the basic part of his second to the last word, and it's what you're preaching all the time at the end of our show.
Yep. Pre-planning, you know, it looks like he may have done a good pre-departure check. Does it seem to be no issues there? You know, was he paying attention? Did he have the head on the swivel? Maybe, maybe not. Maybe there was a few lapses in there. He lost the horizon, obviously. You know, all that takes is one turn of the head the wrong way. You come back and you've lost the horizon. So there's a lot of mistakes made. Before the flight took off and during the flight, obviously, that got him in condition to fly it into the ground. It sounds like, at first read, when I looked at it, I thought about the JFK Jr. flight. Same thing. We, the NTSB, believed that JFK Jr. turned around to talk to his sister-in-law in the back seat and then turned around back looking forward. And we know because one of our employees, Dennis, was flying that same area that night, and the horizon was blended right in with the ocean. There was no clear horizon. So turn around, look at your passenger, turn back, you've lost it. If you're not instrument rated, you just lost it.
Well, I don't think this flight should have ever taken off, John, tell you the truth. Again,
he wasn't qualified. He took off when it was nighttime.
And the fact that, again, as part of pre-flight, you have to do a self-evaluation. Am I capable of doing the things that I need to be doing, especially when it came to, you know, when was the last time I flew at night? How competent am I at night? How proficient am I at night? And I'm going off to an airport. We don't know how much experience he had at Ocean City. Is this the first time he's been there? Is this the 100th time he's been there? Why did he go there and try to do the things that he did there? You know, these are the questions that are, you know, don't have an answer. And that's why, again, pre-flight planning is so important. You got to look at your own limitations besides the limitations of the aircraft, but you got to look at your own limitations and go, am I getting myself into something that I shouldn't be doing? And, you know, I'm not going to harp on this, but John, I know you always preach it. And that is, you got to do a good pre-flight. That means, you know, doing a self-evaluation, of yourself and what you're going to do and how you intend to do it. So I'll get off my soapbox and I'll leave you with the very, very last word, John.
Well, we batted around a whole bunch of stuff right around it. The last word is simply, if you fly, put your head on a swivel, because there's a lot of people out there that don't have the experience, and you need to make sure that you keep them away from your airplane. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Since 1961, Avemco Insurance Company has been known as the approachable experts of general aviation insurance. No other insurance company connects you directly to an aviation underwriter, giving you more flexibility, personalized service, and easy-to-read policies customized for you and your flying. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them you're a listener of our podcast and save 5%.
That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detectives. Until the next episode, fly safe.